has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
This year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Ghad Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah City, Palestine.
Again, 120 people were murdered in a massacre by the RSF militia as they attacked a kindergarten, a village, and a hospital. Most of the dead were children aged 3, 4, and 5. The massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
And sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also you know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
The UAE are supporter of the RSF rebels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to address its call on the world foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the sixth such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of 8 World Food Programme workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza. Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pakistan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen the very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relation with the other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be important mediator as compared to the other one, being in as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a stakeholder, so having projects with India, being a state. Because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material: wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27th, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. What is the main problem of the Islamic Ummah today? The main problem is the domination of Western culture over the Islamic Ummah. The main problem is the domination of the Western economy and Western politics over the Islamic Ummah. These are the main problems. Today, there is no sign of Islamic identity in many Islamic countries. Of course, the people in such countries are Muslims. They say daily prayers, they fast, and they probably pay zakat, but society as a whole is lacking in Islamic identity. In other words, there is not a personality or a reality that confronts the reality of evil and kufr. That is why Westerners interfere. They interfere in their culture, in their belief, in their economy, and in their social relationships, and they control their politics. The result is that because of lack of a single identity inside Islamic societies, there is fighting, war, hatred, and lack of understanding. This is what happens. Today, the world of evil is after destroying and annihilating this identity. They want to destroy everything that has remained from this identity in every part of the world. This is an Islamic principle. Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks, and Allah hears and knows all things.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
فمن يكفر بالطاغوت ويؤمن بالله فقد استمسك بالعروة الوثقى لا انفصام لها والله سميع عليم. This is a truth. If we understand this truth correctly, we are committed to it. If we pursue it, and if we turn it into a public reality in the Islamic community and the Islamic Ummah, notice what a great transformation will take place. Notice what a great transformation this single truth, and there are hundreds of such truths in the Quran, will bring about in the world. If we understand, believe in, and promote this very issue and concept, notice what will happen. The Quran should be understood. We are very distant from the Quran. The enemy is taking advantage of our distance from the Quran. The enemy is injecting in us lack of faith, decadence, and dependence on himself on a daily basis.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna
Flash Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's near daily airstrikes on Lebanon, which have killed many civilians despite a ceasefire in place, are heightening fears of a wider war. Beirut warns that a full-scale Israeli attack may be imminent as regional and international actors have sounded the alarm as well. Analysts caution that without urgent diplomacy, the confrontation could spiral into a devastating and widespread regional conflict.
Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country. Youssef Raji said Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for a large-scale military operation against Lebanon. He said Lebanon is intensifying diplomatic contacts to shield the country and its vital facilities from the potential strikes. The remarks come in the wake of a fresh round of Israeli airstrikes on Lebanese soil. On Friday, regime's warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks across the country. The regime claimed that the attacks targeted Hezbollah sites and rocket launchers. However, witnesses said the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Despite the ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon in November 2024, Israeli airstrikes have continued almost daily, with little respite. The regime also maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon. This persistent aggression has sparked international condemnation, particularly from the United Nations. A UN report published this month revealed that at least 127 Lebanese civilians, including children, have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The UN has characterized these ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. Many believe that the attacks aim at pressuring Hezbollah movement to lay down its arms and reach a new deal with the Lebanese government. However, the group has ruled out any new agreement with Israel, saying that intimidation will not change Hezbollah's stance of resistance. It says U.S. and Israel's calls for disarmament are designed to weaken Lebanon and leave it exposed to external aggression. Analysts warn that the escalating confrontation risks plunging the region into a wider conflict with devastating consequences. For now, Lebanon's leadership and resistance insist that only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war.
Well, here are our guests for tonight's edition of Spotlight. Activist and commentator Mick Napier joining us from Glasgow. And we also have journalist and political commentator Leila Hatoum joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the program, to both my guests. Let's start off with Ms. Hatoum in Beirut. Now, Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of an imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country and that Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for this large-scale military operation. Why is the Israeli regime continuing to seek escalation while it's in a supposed ceasefire with Lebanon?
You have to understand one thing. When the Israelis threaten, that means they're not going to do any action. When they want to do action, they directly do it. So the escalation that we've been seeing over the past 11 to 12 months along our border, since the signing of, it's been a year, since the cessation of hostilities agreement between Lebanon and the Israeli occupation, the Israelis have been breaching it on a daily basis. 2 months ago, they said that they're going to escalate their aggression against Lebanon, and they didn't care, and this is what they did. Daily aggressions. In fact, less than 2 hours ago, before I came over to the studio, the Israeli occupation opened fire through one of their frigates against one of our, basically what you call a fisherman's boat, and then they threw a sound grenade against one of the fishermen in his boat in the sea off the coast of Ras al-Makura, that's in basically southern Lebanon's western sector. So having said that, the Israelis, nothing stops them if they want to do something. When they threaten openly, it means they are not going to do anything, and they're trying to create pressure, fear-mongering, to push the Lebanese towards either trying to disarm the resistance or put more pressure on the resistance internally so that the resistance doesn't do any action. Also, you have to remember another thing. The Israelis don't fight during winter time. That's why most of their agreements happen around the months of October or November, because they don't fight during December and January. You just look throughout their history. They can't do a wide-scale escalation on the ground during winter time. So what they can do is, like, they continue to bombard us by warplanes, and this is what they're doing on a daily basis.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Napier as well. Mick Napier, Israeli jets have recently carried out more than a dozen strikes in South Lebanon. The Israeli military claims it hit Hezbollah training sites, but witnesses say that the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Now, in that regard, the Hezbollah chief just last week said Israeli attacks have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons, and rather it's the expansionist regime seeking to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and initiating the Greater Israel Project through the Lebanese front. Do you see it in that light as well?
Israelis do and say since 48 makes sense of that conclusion. Israel's got the Zionist project has a built-in DNA of expansionism, of appropriating more and more territory. Some of them now are talking about dividing Syria and seizing the land and incorporating the land that they seized into the Israeli state, as they did with the Golan. So this expansionism is nothing new, and the Israelis talk about it openly. What I think is interesting, though, is in a very sophisticated and detailed analysis from our guest in Beirut, is that when the Israelis talk about an attack on the Lebanese resistance, everything they say belies that, because they even discuss in their staff colleges, and they discuss openly, the so-called Dahiya doctrine, named after the suburb of southern suburb of Beirut, which they devastated in a previous attack. And by that they mean, and they say this very explicitly, they will respond to resistance by resistance forces by destroying civilian infrastructure, by exacting a price. Now, this is a war crime, clearly a war crime, but they reckon that with Donald Trump in the White House, they have an even greener light than they had from Biden. And I think it's interesting, I would put it no higher, it's interesting that the same week and days that Trump is seizing tankers off the coast of Venezuela, escalating to outright banditry, Israel attacks Lebanese fishing boats and so on. I think that they've got a green light from Washington, not just in words, but actually in action. So what the Lebanese, of course, expect from Israel is no mercy, that they have to resist, they have to fight back. The whole record of every Israeli attack on Lebanon from 1982, 2000 and so on, the occupation of the south for 20 years, shows that the only thing that will make Lebanon, will preserve Lebanon as an independent state, is the most determined and sadly very costly resistance by Hezbollah and other resistance forces. Israel is brutal, committed to massacring Lebanese civilians It's part of their military doctrine, and I think Lebanese know that as well.
Leila Hatoum, Lebanon's leadership and the resistance insist that for now, only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war. But since the truce took effect back in November of 2024, Israel has violated the agreement on an almost daily basis, leaving more than 340 people killed. So diplomacy has never been a language that the Israelis understood, has it? And in addition to that, what about the inaction of the guarantors to this ceasefire?
Right. I'll start with the last thing first. When the guarantors to this ceasefire are the same ones who are supplying the Israeli occupation with weapons and international impunity, to what extent do you think that these guarantors are going to hold their word in terms of basically protecting Lebanon or banning the Israelis from actually breaching that ceasefire? The cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed on the 26th of November 2024 and came into effect on November 27th, 2024, and basically fully came into effect around January 26th, 2025, hasn't been respected by the Israeli occupation since then until today. More than 5,000 breaches to that cessation of hostilities on part of the Israeli occupation had been witnessed and documented even by the United Nations interim forces in South Lebanon. The United Nations even called it war crimes and basically a breach of that ceasefire. So basically, we cannot rely on these guarantors to get us anywhere. When it comes to international diplomacy, you also have to understand one thing, that international diplomacy has done nothing for Lebanon since 1948 until today, because the Israeli occupation continued to occupy Lebanese territories, not from 1948, but actually from 1945, when they occupied parts of Hunin, the outskirts of Hunin, and they started building their basically Meskav Am settlement, among other settlements over there. So, having looked into this whole situation, since when also did the Israelis respect any of the cessation of hostilities or agreements or even the armistice agreement that we signed with them since 1949? The Israelis breached it seven times between 1949 and 1967 before the Israelis themselves actually targeted Lebanon and occupied most of its southern parts in the 1967 war, which Lebanon had no hand in it. The Israelis were fighting with the Jordanians, the Syrians, and the Egyptians at the time. Lebanon had no hand in that war, and still they actually targeted Lebanon, which was the first country to sign an armistice agreement with them. Since then, until today, the Israelis continue to aggress Lebanon. International diplomacy does nothing. By 2006, both parties agreed to the 1701 UN Security Council resolution. The Israelis should have actually withdrawn from southern Lebanese territories, but they didn't. They continued to breach that resolution nearly 3,000 times between 2006 and 2023, until this whole, what you call, aggression on Lebanon and the fighting started. It's a full-scale war and war crime against Lebanon. So again, if the international guarantors are not going to respect their word, and they haven't shown us any example in the past to respect their word, if the Israelis are not going to respect their word, and that shows us throughout history that they never respected any of the agreements we signed with them, then basically we have no other choice. When it comes to the leadership of the resistance, as well as the Lebanese leadership, and I'm speaking about the president himself, they have the same point. The Israelis have to withdraw from Lebanon and stop threatening us and
right.
Stop targeting us. Otherwise, resistance is our rightful right under international law.
Mick Napier, the United Nations has characterized the ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. We know last week the Lebanese president met with a delegation from the Security Council in Beirut, urging the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire, withdraw from Lebanon. Apparently that didn't work. So the UN has done nothing with regards to any of the Israeli violations in Lebanon, also the daily massacres in Gaza. How does this reflect on the credibility of the UN when it seems so helpless in the face of Israeli violations?
Time when the UN and even the US would condemn Israel. Our guest will remember the year, it escapes me at the moment. I think in the 60s or 70s, when Palestinians hijacked an Israeli aircraft, Israel attacked Beirut Airport and destroyed the Lebanese civilian aircraft fleet quite deliberately. Now, at that time, the US criticized them and the UN criticized them. But they didn't do anything about it. They didn't impose any sanctions. But today, we don't even hear a word of criticism. There never has been a word of criticism. All we hear is of And it's quite consistent, by the way, Hamas savages, Hezbollah savages, wonderful Israeli troops who are the greatest moral army in the world. Reality is turned on its head every single day and every single report. Look, I don't think your viewers understand the barbarity of past Israeli attacks on Lebanon. In 1982, my God, the Los Angeles Times reported Israeli vehicles, Israeli big trucks were stealing Lebanese cars and taking them off to Israel. They stole the computer system from Beirut Airport. They stole the contents of libraries, and they devastated cultural centers in Lebanon. So the banditry and the extreme levels of savagery and contempt for the UN are very telling. Another thing, by the way, that happened in 1982 was, and the Israeli newspapers reported this, when a UN committee was coming to the city that was occupied, an Arab capital occupied by the Israeli military, shortly before the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, a UN committee came to the city, and the Israeli military on that day shelled the center of Beirut with high explosive shells, killing a lot of people. And the Israeli newspapers understood the joke. They shelled the city at 2:42, 18 minutes to 3, and 3:38. The numbers of the UN resolutions that attempted to constrain Israeli criminality. And the Israeli newspaper said, yes, that the joke was obvious. So Israel has demonstrated its contempt for the United Nations in Lebanese blood by massacring people in order to send a message. So it seems to me, when you look at the record, no crime, the devastation of Dahiya, the Israelis openly talking about the Dahiya doctrine. This is what they will impose if they have to go into Lebanon. And all these other examples of extreme criminality and contempt for the United Nations, that tells us what Israel thinks of the UN.
Leila Hatoum, on the issue of the disarmament of the Lebanese resistance, we know the Israeli regime maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon, occupying those regions. You just mentioned earlier that the government should be focused more on issues like ending the Israeli occupation and the regime's daily attacks. So why is the Lebanese government pursuing such a self-harming path? And who would actually benefit from Hezbollah's disarmament?
Well, unfortunately for us, the Lebanese government is inactive and it's unwilling to confront the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, we have some elements in main positions inside the government who are adamant at relinquishing Lebanon's right to resist, despite the fact that it has been ensured to every population and country in this world under international law. So at the end of the day, when you look at the situation, we do have some elements that kind of what you call execute an Israeli-American agenda in Lebanon, and then they claim it's under what you call trying to maintain Lebanon's sovereignty. In that sense, when you have our foreign affairs minister going out, all out and about to justify the Israeli occupation's aggression on Lebanon, and that happened a few months back, and everybody had criticized him on that, it means that he is complicit one way or another, even as a foreign affairs minister, in terms of giving the Israelis the upper hand to use his words against Lebanon. I have never seen a minister throughout history, unless they were appointed by an occupation, justify for the occupation the what you call atrocities and war crimes committed against his own people. So at the end of the day, when I look at what's happening on the ground, the government is facilitating continued Israeli aggressions on Lebanon by not arming the Lebanese army, or at least using diplomacy, as they call it. If they think that diplomacy is going to work wonders for them, why don't they use diplomacy to arm the Lebanese army? We heard the Americans very loud and clear through their envoy to the region and basically their ambassador in Turkey, Tom Barrack, when he said, we're not going to arm the Lebanese army to fight the Israelis. We want to arm it to fight its own people and disarm the resistance. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, I do believe that this government, at least, will not be able to do anything. It's a transitional government. They will not be able to disarm the resistance for a reason. The resistance will not lay down its arms so long that there is an occupation. The president himself, who has very what you call mitigated decisions, not decisions, but positions in certain points, he was very adamant and clear when he said that we cannot achieve peace so long that the Israeli occupation continues to occupy Lebanese territories and continue to aggress the Lebanese.
Meek Napier, about the greater Israel scheme, Benjamin Netanyahu and many other right-wing ministers have openly talked about the quote-unquote vision of a greater Israel, and they constantly brag about the expansionist project. What does this mean, not just for Palestinians, but for the entire region? And who are the main obstacles to an Israeli occupation spanning across West Asia?
That's the $64 million question. The Israelis have made it abundantly clear they don't see the current borders of so-called Israel as in any way permanent. They're only a temporary thing to be expanded going forward. But you know, they cannot even attempt this without the US backing. You know, a settler colonial project like the Jewish supremacist state in Palestine, it necessarily is at war with its neighbors, because they're killing Arabs in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, because they are Arabs. And, you know, that doesn't play well with the people in neighboring societies, neighboring countries. So it's got a built-in instability where there's inevitably hatred and anger towards Israel. But that's not allowed to come out because the local governments inhibit it. But it's a permanent situation. If you look at South Africa, for example, before white supremacy was defeated, they devastated neighboring countries, Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, and so on, because they had to, in a sense, before they were defeated. And I think it's the lessons of history is, for the people of the region, there's a terrible price to be paid for this Zionist project until it is defeated and put in the dustbin of history. So the lessons are there. And I think this the Israeli attitude to Lebanon is also colored by their need to assert what they call their deterrent edge. That means they have to be able to terrorize all their neighbors with the conclusion that they cannot resist the Israeli juggernaut. And because they failed to exterminate the resistance in Gaza, which is absolutely astonishing, because they actually failed in their war aims in Gaza, and they failed to defeat the Yemenis, they failed to defeat the Lebanese resistance, they feel a need. Because remember, there are 6 or 7 million Zionist Jews in Israel-Palestine at the moment, and they're surrounded by 600 million people who can see what's going on. In order for them to survive, they need terror, state terror, continuous and unending state terror. And that will be the reality, I'm afraid, for the people of Lebanon and Palestine and Jordan and Syria and Iraq and Yemen, as long as the Zionist project continues with an airlift of weapons, 2,000-pound bombs and money and so on, from Washington and from Europe.
Sure. Leila Hatoum, the so-called Greater Israel map includes Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in some illustrations, Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait. How has the silence and lack of proper action and outrage from other Arab countries further emboldened the Israelis? Who's to say that the Israelis won't set their sights on more Arab land in the future?
Who said that they wouldn't? I'll tell you some funny story that happened to me a few months back when Netanyahu said that he held the map of Greater Israel and he was speaking about it. It clearly showed that nearly half of Saudi Arabia was part of that land. And I was asked a question by one of the Arab media outlets. And I said, I don't know why the Saudis don't want us to actually resist and they call our resistance terrorists. But if Netanyahu takes over Mecca, would they actually fight to defend their land? And instead of the Saudis basically attacking Netanyahu over what he said, they attacked me. They considered that I was hoping that the Israelis would take over the Saudi territories. So at the end of the day, so long that the Arabs fight one another at any point, the Israelis will just sit back and relax and basically just throw more sedition and watch us basically finish each other before they move in. The Israelis will move over to take over more lands. And if they don't control the lands, they don't have to control the lands. You have to understand, Greater Israel doesn't necessarily mean that the Israelis will have physical presence on the ground in control. What they can do is basically change the regimes or change governments or basically just install a puppet leadership that they can control, and then basically they will work through that. Look at Syria. And at the end of the day, if I would say something, I want to just rectify this notion. The Israeli entity is not a state under international law. Technically, it needs to have fixed borders with people on that land governed by a political body. They do have the people and they have the political body, but they don't have fixed borders. They still don't have fixed borders with Lebanon, and they still don't have fixed borders with Syria. That's why they are pushing Lebanon to sign a treaty to actually what you call redemarcate our land borders to fit their whims. And same thing with Syria. That's why they're taking more land at the moment before they sign over anything. They occupied 700 kilometers squared since the beginning of this year until now, and nobody has said anything from southern Syrian territories. So when I look at the whole situation, we do have a rogue regime that's enabled by the international community to take over more lands from around its neighbors. And whenever those neighbors try to say no, they will call them terrorists.
All right, we're out of time for the show right now. Mick Napier, just quickly, if you may, in 30 seconds or less probably, how can the status quo change with the all-out support from Washington and most of all, the lack of accountability for Israeli crimes in the region?
Israel's criminal impulses are financed, supported by the collective West. Without that, they could not act as they do. And that's the bitter reality. The only antidote to that is a worldwide movement against the Zionist entity across the region. That will take the form of armed struggle and popular movements, but also around the world in America, Britain, Germany, France, etc. Growing resentment and anger towards Israel has led to thousands of arrests in Britain, thousands of arrests under so-called terrorism legislation. The mood is there to fight the Israeli state.
Okay.
Zionism a memory, but that's the only alternative to endless suffering for the people of the region.
Okay, that's the end for tonight's show. Thanks to activist and commentator Mick Napier joining us from Glasgow. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Leila Hatoum speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. A special thanks to you for staying with us on Tradition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en.